All the senior staff from the museum and the Department of Antiquities were at the funeral service in the Church of the Oasis. Even Atalan Abu Sin, the Minister of Culture and Tourism, and Durayed's superior, had come out from Cairo in his official black air-conditioned Mercedes. He stood behind Royan, and though he was a Muslim, joined in the responses. Nahut Gudabi stood beside his uncle. Nahut's mother was the minister's youngest sister, which, as Durayed had sarcastically pointed out, fully made up for the nephew's lack of qualifications and experience in archaeology and for his ineptitude as an administrator. The day was sweltering. Outside, the temperature stood at over 30 degrees, and even in the dim cloisters of the Coptic church, it was oppressive. In the thick clouds of incense, smoke, and the drone of the black-clad priest intoning the ancient order of service, Royan felt herself suffocating. The stitches in her right arm pulled and burned, and every time she looked at the long black coffin that stood in front of the ornate and gilded altar, the dreadful vision of Durayed's bald and scorched head rose before her eyes, and she swayed in her seat and had to catch herself before she fell. At last it was over, and she could escape into the open air and the desert sunlight. Even then her duties were not at an end. As principal mourner, her place was directly behind the coffin as they walked in procession to the cemetery amongst the palm groves, where Durayed's relatives awaited him in the family mausoleum. Before he returned to Cairo, Atalan Abu Sin came to shake her hand and offer her a few words of condolence. "What a terrible business, Royan. I have personally spoken to the Minister of the Interior. They will catch the animals responsible for this outrage, believe me. Please take as long as you need before you return to the museum," he told her. "I will be in my office again on Monday," she replied. And he drew a pocket diary from inside the jacket of his dark double-breasted suit. He consulted it and made a note before he looked up at her again. "Then come to see me at the ministry in the afternoon, 4 o'clock. He told her. He went to the waiting Mercedes while Nahut Gudabi came forward to shake hands. Though his skin was sallow and there were coffee-coloured stains beneath his dark eyes, he was tall and elegant, with thick wavy hair and very white teeth. His suit was impeccably tailored, and he smelled faintly of an expensive cologne. His expression was grave and sad. "He was a good man. I held Durayed in the highest esteem," he told Royan. And she nodded without replying to this blatant untruth. There had been a little affection between Durayed and his deputy. He had never allowed Nahut to work on the Taita scrolls. In particular, he had never given him access to the 7th scroll, and this had been a point of bitter antagonism between them. "I hope you will be applying for the post of director, Royan," he told her. "You are well qualified for the job." "Thank you, Nahut. You are very kind. I haven't had a chance to think about the future yet. But won't you be applying?" "Of course," he nodded. "But that doesn't mean that no one else should. Perhaps you will take the job out from in front of my nose." His smile was complacent. She was a woman in an Arab world, and he was the nephew of the minister. Nahut knew just how heavily the odds favoured him. "Friendly rivals?" he asked. Royan smiled sadly. "Friends, at least. I will need all of those I can find in the future." "You know you have many friends. Everyone in the department likes you, Royan." That at least was true, she supposed. He went on smoothly. "May I offer you a lift back to Cairo? I am certain my uncle will not object." "Thank you, Nahut, but I have my own car here, and I must stay over at the Oasis tonight to see to some of Durayed's affairs." This was not true. Royan planned to travel back to the flat in Giza that evening. But for reasons that she was not very sure of herself, she did not want Nahut to know of her plans. "Then we shall see you at the museum on Monday." Royan left the Oasis as soon as she was able to escape from the relations and family, friends and peasants, so many of whom had worked for Durayed's family most of their lives. She felt numbed and isolated, so that all their condolences and pious exhortations were meaningless and without comfort. Even at this late hour, the tarmac road back through the desert was busy, with files of vehicles moving steadily in both directions, for tomorrow was Friday and the Sabbath. She slipped her injured right arm out of the sling, and it did not hamper her driving too much. She was able to make reasonably good time. Nevertheless, it was after 5 in the afternoon when she made out the green line against the tawny desolation of the desert that marked the start of the narrow strip of irrigated and cultivated land along the Nile, which was the great artery of Egypt. As always, the traffic became denser the nearer she came to the capital, and it was almost fully dark by the time she reached the apartment block in Giza that overlooked both the river and those great monuments of stone which stood so tall and massive against the evening sky, and which, for her, epitomized the heart and history of her land. She left Durayed's old green Renault in the underground garage of the building and rode up in the elevator to the top floor. She let herself into the flat and then froze in the doorway. The sitting room had been ransacked. Even the rugs had been pulled up and the paintings ripped from the walls. In a daze, she picked her way through the litter of broken furniture and smashed ornaments. She glanced into the bedroom as she went down the passage and saw that it had not escaped. Her clothes and those of Durayed were strewn over the floor, and the doors of the cupboard stood ajar. One of these was smashed off its hinges. The bed was overturned, and the sheets and bolsters had been flung about. She could smell the reek of broken cosmetic and perfume bottles from the bathroom, but she could not yet bring herself to go in there. She knew what she would find. Instead, she continued down the passage to the large room that they had used as a studio and workshop. In the chaos, the first thing that she noticed and mourned was the antique chess set that Durayed had given her as a wedding present. The board of jet and ivory squares was broken in half, and the pieces had been thrown about the room with vindictive and unnecessary violence. She stooped and picked up the White Queen. Her head had been snapped off. Holding the Queen in her good hand, she moved like a sleepwalker to her desk below the window. Her PC was wrecked. They had shattered the screen and hacked the mainframe with what must have been an axe. She could tell at a glance that there was no information left on the hard drive. It was beyond repair. She glanced down at the drawer in which she kept her floppy disks. That and all the other drawers had been pulled out and thrown onto the floor. They were empty, of course, along with the disks. All her notebooks and photographs were missing. Her last connections with the seventh scroll were lost. After 3 years of work, gone was the proof that it had ever existed. She slumped down onto the floor, feeling beaten and exhausted. Her arm started to ache again, and she was alone and vulnerable, as she had never been in her life before. She had never thought that she would miss Durayed so desperately. Her shoulders began to shake, and she felt the tears welling up from deep within her. She tried to hold them back, but they scalded her eyelids, and she let them flow. She sat amongst the wreckage of her life and wept until there was nothing more left within her. And then she curled up on the littered carpet and fell into the sleep of exhaustion and despair. By the Monday morning, she'd managed to restore some order into her life. The police had come to the flat and taken her statement, and she had tidied up most of the disarray. She had even glued the head back on her White Queen. When she left the flat and climbed into the green Renault, her arm was feeling easier, and, if not cheerful, she was at least a great deal more optimistic and sure of what she had to do. When she reached the museum, she went first to Durayed's office and was annoyed to find that Nahut was there before her. He was supervising two of the security guards as they cleared out all Durayed's personal effects. "You might have had the consideration to let me do that," she told him coldly. And he gave her his most winning smile. "I am sorry, Royan. I thought I would help." He was smoking one of his fat Turkish cigarettes. She loathed the heavy, musky odour. She crossed to Durayed's desk and opened the top right-hand drawer. "My husband's daybook was in here. It's gone now. Have you seen it?" "No, there was nothing in that drawer." Nahut looked at the two guards for confirmation, and they shuffled their feet and shook their heads. It did not really matter, she thought. The book had not contained much of vital interest. Duryea had always relied on her to record and store all data of importance, and most of it had been on her PC. Thank you, Nahut, she dismissed him. I will do whatever remains to be done. I don't want to keep you from your work. Any help you need, Rayan, please let me know. He bowed slightly as he left her. It did not take her long to finish in Duryea's office. She had the guards take the boxes of her possessions down the corridor to her own office and pile them against the wall. She worked through the lunch hour, tidying up all her own affairs, and when she had finished, there was still an hour until her appointment with Atalan Abu Sin. If she was to make good her promise to Duryea, then she was going to be absent for some time. Wanting to take leave of all her favourite treasures, she went down into the public section of the huge building. Monday was a busy day, and the exhibition halls of the museum were thronged with groups of tourists. They flocked behind their guides, sheep following the shepherd. They crowded around the most famous of the displays. They listened to the guides reciting their well-rehearsed spiels in all the tongues of Babel. Those rooms on the second floor that contained the treasures of Tutankhamun were so crowded that she spent little time there. She managed to reach the display cabinet that contained the great golden death mask of the child pharaoh. As always, the splendour and the romance of it quickened her breathing and made her heart beat faster. Yet, as she stood before it, jostled by a pair of big-busted and sweaty middle-aged female tourists, she pondered, as she had so often before, that if an insignificant weakling king could have gone to his tomb with such a miraculous creation, covering his mummified features, in what state must the great Ramessids have lain in their funeral temples? Ramesses II, the greatest of them all, had reigned 67 years and had spent those decades accumulating his funerary treasure from all the vast territories that he had conquered. Rohan went next to pay her respects to the old king. After 30 centuries, Ramesses II slept on with a rapt and serene expression on his gaunt features. His skin had a light marble-like sheen to it. The sparse strands of his hair were blonde and dyed with henna. His eyes, dyed with the same stuff, were long and thin and elegant. However, he was clad only in a rag of linen. The grave robbers had even unwrapped his mummy to reach the amulets and scarabs beneath the linen bandages, so that his body was almost naked. When these remains had been discovered in 1881 in the cache of royal mummies in the cliff cave at Deir el-Bahari, only a scrap of papyrus parchment attached to his breast had proclaimed his lineage. There was a moral in that, she supposed, but as she stood before these pathetic remains, she wondered again, as she and Duryea had done so often before, whether Taita the scribe had told the truth, whether somewhere in the far-off savage mountains of Africa another great pharaoh slept on, undisturbed, with all his treasures intact about him. The very thought of it made her shiver with excitement, and goose pimples prickled her skin and raised the fine dark hair at the nape of her neck. "I have given you my promise, my husband," she whispered in Arabic. "This will be for you and your memory, for it was you who led the way." She glanced at her wristwatch as she went down the main staircase. She had 15 minutes before she must leave for her appointment with the minister, and she knew exactly how she would spend that time. What she was going to visit was in one of the less frequented side halls. The tour guides very seldom led their charges this way, except as a shortcut to see the statue of Amenhotep. Rohan stopped in front of the glass-fronted display case that reached from floor to ceiling of the narrow room. It was packed with small artifacts, tools and weapons, amulets and vessels and utensils, the latest of them dating from the 20th dynasty of the New Kingdom, 1100 BC, whilst the oldest surviving from the dim ages of the Old Kingdom almost 5,000 years ago. The cataloguing of this accumulation was only rudimentary. Many of the items were not described. At the furthest end, on the bottom shelf, was a display of jewellery and finger rings and seals. Beside each of the seals was a wax impression made from it.